Hello, listeners. Welcome back to another edition of Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on Nerdcast, a conviction, a guilty plea, an indictment, a big week in national politics. We are going to talk about the split-screen reality we saw on display this week after the president's one-time campaign manager was convicted of financial crimes and his one-time attorney pleaded guilty to a host of white-collar goodies. Plus, we're going to walk through what it all means for the midterms as Democrats hammer Republicans, including the newly indicted Congressman Duncan Hunter, over corruption in Washington. A reminder to our listeners to subscribe to the Nerdcast, rate us, and write a review. And one more note before we begin, we are taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday, August 23rd. So if anyone else gets indicted in the afternoon, that's why we're not talking about it. All right, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests. We have senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian back from a summer vacation. Charlie, so good to see you. We missed you.
Scott, it is so great to be back and just to look at you and sit this close.
You missed the Nerdcast while you were on vacation, didn't you?
I did. I pined for the Nerdcast.
And from our White House team, we have Lorraine Wollert. Good to see you, Lorraine. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, time for our first data point. It is the number 8. That's 8 counts apiece that Paul Manafort was found guilty of in a courthouse in Alexandria, Virginia, and that Michael Cohen pled guilty to almost simultaneously in a federal courtroom in New York City. Manafort obviously ran Donald Trump's campaign for a few key months in 2016, and Cohen was Donald Trump's lawyer and enforcer going back many years. So, Lorraine, let's dig into it. What have we seen so far this week about how Trump and his White House are addressing the fallout from these two massive legal events, the verdict and the plea?
Well, they're basically doing what they've always done, which is just denying and ignoring, right? So, the president is, he's taken aim at Cohen. So that's one thing. Cohen's a lousy lawyer, apparently, now. And he's just sort of saying that Manafort had nothing to do with him, which in this case, the current convictions of Manafort are actually unrelated to the campaign. So inside the White House, there's some angst.
Angst.
There's some discussion, do we go to pardoning? Already. I mean, don't forget Manafort has another trial coming up. So Maybe they want to wait till after that trial before they get to the pardoning. So far, it's, Trump is kind of sort of ignoring a lot of it.
It's just incredible to me that, that we're talking about pardons and that this is all happening. And that also, Charlie, one of the big defenses is, look, there's no evidence of collusion in any of this. I've been thinking a lot about what Trump said during the campaign, that he could walk down Fifth Avenue and shoot someone in the head and everyone would still love him. And I mean, he's literally saying, pay no attention to this other crime that I might have committed. It wasn't collusion with Russians, so gotcha.
Yeah, it turned out to be true, like that he probably could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and still have a good bit of his base would stay with him because he could obfuscate and muddy the waters and deny that it was him or, come up with some explanation and they would all stick with him. What more can you say about this? You just can't make sense of it. It's the black swan presidency and, Bombshell Tuesday is, a perfect case in point. It delivered, all of it's like this witch's brew of politically toxic developments that would have destroyed any other administration. Even one of them would have sunk many presidents, yet they have 3 in one day. The two people close to Trump, Cohen and Manafort. But then you have the indictment of a leading congressional supporter of the president. And that comes 2 weeks after another congressional Republican, the first one to back Trump back when his presidential bid was so improbable, Chris Collins. He's been indicted. Yet despite all of this, there are still strong indications that it's not going to move the dial.
Like you said, Charlie, I think it's not his base is not going to just evaporate between all this stuff. That much is clear at this point. I'm a little less convinced about the whether or not it'll move the dial. I think we can wait and see what happens. But Lorraine, you had a really interesting window into I think what we called it before the split screen reality, right? The fact that Trump's base or a big portion of it is just going to be there no matter what on Tuesday as this was all happening, because you were flying on Air Force One to a Trump rally in West Virginia as this was all going down. Tell us about it.
Exactly. So being on Air Force One sounds really cool, but when news is happening, it's almost like the worst place to be because you get on the plane and your phone is shut down. There's no Wi-Fi, and you know, it's very rare that anybody comes to the back of the plane to actually talk to you. So you're literally in this little bubble removed from the entire universe. So it was a little bit stressful, actually, even though the president was just a few rows ahead of me in the front of the plane. I couldn't have been further from the action. It was about 4 o'clock, and that's when everything broke. That's about when the wheels lifted off the ground and our phones blinked out and we lost Wi-Fi and all connectivity. The presidency seemed on some sort of brink, and I was trapped with no communication and Trump sitting up front, obviously not coming back to talk to us about what was going on. We finally landed. It was a quick flight. We landed in Charleston, and the president stopped to chat with us. The reporters were screaming at him, asking about Manafort and Cohen. And Trump gave a couple brief remarks. It was maybe two minutes at most. He told us that Manafort was a good guy, felt bad for the guy, gave us a little history about what an awesome guy Manafort was. And then we all hopped into the motorcade. We're frantically trying to transcribe our recordings of what the president just told us. And we get to the rally. It was not completely to capacity crowd. It was pretty good crowd. The president was in the back meeting with his fundraisers. So, you know, I had some time to try to connect with some rally goers, some Trump supporters. We were penned into a cage. So I couldn't just wander through the crowd. I tried to, you know, bring some people over, lure people over to talk to me. It didn't quite work out. But one fellow did stop to talk. His name is Rick Hunt. He lives in Charleston. I asked him about Manafort and Cohen. And he said, you know, I really miss Walter Cronkite.
That's the way it is.
Okay, Rick, I miss him too. But what about Cohen? What about Manafort? And Rick said, you know, all I know is everyone makes mistakes. But if they try to take Trump out of office, there's going to be a revolt. So I think that was a pretty typical probably sentiment of people in the room. About this time, you know, Mick Jagger was playing Sympathy for the Devil. You know, when that song ended, Pavarotti came on. I didn't know. I was like, who is this? I opened my Shazam app. Got the Pavarotti reference. At about this time, the news broke that Duncan Hunter, a Republican in California and one of Trump's earliest supporters, had also been indicted on campaign corruption charges for misuse of campaign dollars. I was a little bit numb at this point. My palms were sweating. We were all the press corps was sitting there. I think we were all a little bit numb, a little bit subdued. We kind of didn't know. I think we were all in a sort of state of shock. Our colleagues back in the bureaus were doing the heavy lifting, writing these stories, and here we were trapped in a pen at a Trump rally, which could not have been more removed from the reality of the day. The president finally arrived. There was some campaign chatter and support for, you know, candidates in West Virginia. And then he started his speech. We were, all of us, ready to go. You know, laptops at the ready, phones taping, and because we expected him to say something. We expected him to address the news at hand, the stuff that was consuming the rest of the country at that moment. We expected him to be part of it. And instead, he started talking about ESPN.
It was just announced by ESPN that rather than defending our anthem, our beautiful, beautiful national...
I was figuratively speechless at that moment. I didn't know what to say. He segued into coal. This is coal country, of course.
You guys have a lot of courage.
Beautiful coal.
But we love clean, beautiful West Virginia coal. We love
coal
it.
Coal is back.
Right.
He took some shots at Joe Manchin, the Democratic senator from West Virginia who's running for re-election.
He's
in a
Manchin.
Kind of a tough race.
Always voted for Obama.
Didn't mention Senator John McCain by name, but took a shot at John McCain. He's been doing that a lot lately.
But one man, I'm sure nobody knows who I'm talking about, voted no, shockingly, really surprising to a lot of people because he campaigned on repeal and replace. But we've really knocked it out, including the individual mandate. We got rid of the most unpopular part of Obamacare. Are you out of the
room? This was about 7:30, just after 7:30. We've already had three major news events, Cohen, Manafort, and now Duncan Hunter. Well, here was another blockbuster coming down. Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg was getting on the phone with reporters saying that there was new evidence of Russian and Iranian meddling in attempts to sway elections in the United States. Again, major blockbuster news that on any other day probably would have led all the papers. On this day, of course, relegated to fourth place, maybe. We're sitting there. My phone's buzzing with all the news breaking, and a reporter sitting next to me wondered aloud whether Trump was going to pardon Manafort on live TV. But the president's brain just wasn't there. Instead, at that point, he started talking about gross domestic product and our beautiful economy.
We're the greatest country in the world, and we are now the greatest economy that we have ever had. We're the greatest economy in the world. We've gone up $10 trillion in value since my election.
Moving on. About 20 minutes later, Trump finally starts to allude to the news of the day, and he uses the word collusion. So we all, okay, back in position, ready to go, waiting for him to go there, talk about what was happening.
Where is the collusion? You know, they're still looking for collusion. Where is the collusion? Find some collusion. We want to find the collusion.
No, moment passed. On to the next thing. He already changed the subject, started talking about border security.
Is border security. We have to have it.
My phone at that moment buzzed again. This time it was a Bloomberg News alert. The headline was, "It was a terrible day for Trump." If the president had had a terrible day, he wasn't letting on because he was talking about Chevys.
How many Chevrolets are there in the middle of Berlin? Not too many, maybe one.
He moved on after Chevys in Berlin. He started talking about North Korea and then Elton John.
Elton John.
We were really getting confused at this point because, I was like, how did we get to Elton John? I still haven't figured that out. About this time, the crowd turned to boo at us again. The president started talking about real estate and people who don't pay their debts, which he has some experience with, started comparing that to NATO.
And they weren't paying their bills. They were delinquent.
A reporter sitting next to me said, "What's going on?" And I just didn't know. I had no idea.
It's like when you're cooking the chicken. Turkey for Thanksgiving. My mother would say,
toward the end of the rally, Trump kind of got a second wind. We're in West Virginia. The president is definitely playing to the crowd, talking about coal, talking about blue-collar workers, you know, talking about bringing the economy back and jobs. And then he launches into a familiar riff about the elite. And tells the crowd that they're the elite, they're the super elite, and they need to embrace this sort of identity.
You're the elite. So let them have the word elite. You're the super elite. That's what it is.
And then, of course, starts talking about himself.
Please, you're winning too much for West Virginia. Please stop winning. And I'm going to say, Patrick, I'm sorry.
At this point, the president was winding down, and we were told we had to leave. And frankly, we weren't ready to leave. We couldn't believe that this was over because, you know, this day was arguably the most important day of the Trump presidency. And the president had basically ignored it. He had basically ignored everything that had happened that day. So here it is about 8:30, and we were just going to hop on the plane and go home. Finally, they made us get up. We had to run for the plane, and the music came back up, and that was it. It was the Rolling Stones again. You can't always get what you want.
A Trump rally classic.
It was a campaign rally. It was nothing special. And then we went back to reality.
Lorraine, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for coming in and talking us through it.
You bet.
And Charlie is sticking around with us for our next data point, which is $250,000, give or take. That's how much campaign money that Congressman Duncan Hunter and his wife allegedly used for personal expenses, according to federal prosecutors who indicted them on Tuesday. That is a lot of fancy lunches and hotel rooms and a whole bunch of other stuff, as the indictment tells us. We are going to pick that apart and talk about how it and the rest of the week's news affects the midterm election picture with our guests here. So alongside Charlie, we've got now on the phone, we've got Natasha Kurecki, Politico's national correspondent out of Chicago. Hello, Natasha.
Hi.
And also on the phone, we've got Politico's Capitol Bureau Chief John Bresnahan. Hi, John. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Thank you so much for joining us. I'm doing great. So, Natasha, broad strokes. You anchored a story this morning about how this week's developments kind of fit in with some campaign themes that we've already been seeing emerging in the midterm landscape.
For Democrats, it builds right off of the message that they've had in play for months now, and that's this culture of corruption messaging that back in May, the party had sort of settled on as a central theme in the midterms without even knowing what was yet to come. And at that point, it had more to do with different ethics scandals hitting the cabinet, Republican tax bill, and tying that back to specific congressmen, their alleged conflicts and their votes. So we've already seen, as you well know, Scott, that we've already been seeing these ads that are sort of tying in battleground districts, tying specific congressmen, how they voted, how does this all link back to corruption in Washington? And so now Democrats believe this around the clock coverage of Manafort and Cohen and all the scandals involving people in Trump's realm, that it all goes to help underscore this broader argument, which is this is what you get when Republicans control Congress.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting. There's actually been some talk I've seen in the last few days, which I disagree with vehemently, about how it's like, oh, Democrats actually aren't focusing on culture corruption. Someone wrote a story about how few of their ads are about corruption. What I think, though, is that the ads that I'm seeing and paying attention to are all about health care and taxes. And those are the two issues that Democrats really want to own in the midterms. But what you said, Natasha, they're using this corruption angle to get into those. It's not just, oh, so-and-so voted for the Republican health care plan. It's so-and-so took X dollars from Y special interests, and they voted to do this to your health insurance. And we actually have a clip here from one of the DCCC's earliest TV ads in Kansas that we can play right now.
Kevin Yoder likes to pretend he looks out for Kansans, but he's really a Washington insider, taking care of the special interests at our expense. Yoder took over $1 million in campaign contributions from Wall Street and financial interests and voted to give them huge.
And so you can hear.
Now they want to cut Medicare and Social Security to pay for it.
You know, clearly in this, like, what they want to do, and it's not so much that they're necessarily going to be running ads, right, Natasha, about Manafort or about Cohen or even necessarily about Trump, but it's that all this is kind of building the background noise that feeds into this part of their midterm argument.
Right. I mean, Democrats truly believe that if people are going to fire their congressman, it's going to be because of a vote and because of something that's a kitchen table issue that people care about, and that keeps bringing them back to healthcare and taxes. And that's not going to change. Even, you know, Manafort and Cohen, as we said today, they're not going to be appearing in these ads because they don't think they need to use them in ads. You know, why spend precious campaign money on something that's getting so much publicity in the background. But they think that that's sort of, as one of the strategists said to us yesterday, that every day there's a new cherry put on top of the story of corruption. So that's in the backdrop. And then they kind of hone in on these issues that aren't getting a lot of airing now. I mean, who's talking or writing about you know, the tax bill or healthcare right now?
Right.
Pretty much no one.
Right. Now, of course, one district where we might expect to see some very specific messaging on corruption would be Duncan Hunter's, who we mentioned at the top of the segment, indicted this week for spending campaign money on himself and his family. Brez, you've been following this whole story for a long time now.
Two years.
Walk us through, tell us about who Duncan Hunter is. And then walk us through the charges and what happened here and what he's been accused of.
Well, he and his wife were indicted on 18 counts by the federal grand jury of misusing campaign funds and basically then filing false campaign reports and then fraud. Basically, what they're doing is they're diverting campaign funds to their personal use, which is a crime. The allegations really kind of popped out in the open a couple of years ago. When on campaign reports, Hunter kept there was all this money for video games, and San Diego Union Tribune actually did a story and said, "What's going on with this?" And it turned out it was his kid, and they tried to say, "Well, it was the kid." It was improper charge, and then Hunter tried to. Then there were a bunch of stories about it, and then Hunter tried to bring into his own investigation, quote unquote, and he tried to bring in someone to audit his books for his campaign, which his wife actually worked for the campaign, and he said that he had to repay a bunch of money. He had a bunch of mistaken charges, but there were all sorts of trips and other spending, and this was just on the stuff that was publicly declared. That got to be, you know, that raised red flags. And then the FBI went in and seized his campaign records, and they've been investigating for 2 years. And then, we were writing stories about this for a while. There was a lot of now Hunter is the son of a congressman. His father, Duncan Hunter Sr., served for 28 years in that seat, and then the son, a former Marine, took the seat over a couple of years ago. And, you know, he came to Congress with a lot of promise. He's this tall, you know, good-looking guy, but really has not. He's got a reputation as a partier, did a lot of drinking. I mean, there was an incident earlier this year that Rachel Bate and I wrote about where he got into an argument with Speaker Paul Ryan at a closed-door meeting, and everybody was looking, and they were wondering if he was drunk. So, I mean, there was been a lot of talk about his personal life. Now, I also want to point out, this has happened repeatedly. Jesse Jackson Jr. went to prison, and his wife went to prison over literally the same charge, that they were misusing campaign funds to pay their personal expenses. In Hunter's case, they kept bouncing their checks. They had 1,100 overdraft charges in 7 years, more than 1,100 on their credit cards were maxed out. Clearly, they were living in a lifestyle. The allegation is they were living in a lifestyle they couldn't afford, and they saw the campaign funds, and they started spending it.
Charlie, I mean, let's stick with Duncan Hunter for a second. I mean, this is a district, Brez mentioned that it's been in Republican hands for decades now, right? First with Hunter's father and now with Hunter himself. But it's a district in a state where you really can't get people off the ballot. We saw with Chris Collins in New York, he was able to say, I actually think running for reelection will be a bad idea. It's going to hurt my party. So he jumped off and they're going to replace him. California, no deal. The only way off the ballot is to die a certain number of days after the primary and before the general. And so Republicans are stuck with him in what would under normal circumstances be a gimme district. And you just kind of see these little things adding up.
Yeah, I think it's bad news, particularly to have this happen in Southern California of all places. Southern California, that district, Orange County, some of the other places around there, some of the areas he represents have traditionally been really conservative places that, you know, would never consider voting for a Democrat. But things have changed as demographics have changed in these areas. But they've also changed pretty rapidly during the Trump era, and lots of those races are competitive. Hunter's was not a competitive race, but you could see where the Romney performance was, or I'm sorry, the Trump performance was running behind the Romney performance. So Trump is not well loved in his district. So you could almost imagine a scenario in which Democrats could pick up that district. They probably couldn't hold it over the long term, but sure, in an environment like this one, maybe.
Yeah, and the Democrat running there is kind of an interesting story. His name's Amar Kampanajar, and he worked in the Obama administration. He's of both Mexican and Palestinian heritage, and kind of an interesting story. Tough district, though, as you say, but maybe got a little less tough when your opponent gets indicted.
Yeah, but the thing is, like in a race like this, as you know better than anyone, it doesn't even matter. It could be like Bugs Bunny on the ballot. they'll win for one term, and then they'll get knocked off in 2 years, but. You know, there'll be that anomaly congressman, the member who gets there for 2 years, like the person, I'm sure Natasha, you know.
Doug Jones in Alabama.
Doug Jones, but who was the guy? Mike Flanagan, right? Came in for Dan Rostenkowski in Chicago. They win for about a term, and then they get knocked out 2 years later, but they take advantage of the scandal.
And then, of course, Brez, you'll also remember the case of the Louisiana Democrat with the cash in his freezer, right?
Jefferson.
Yeah, that's right.
William Jefferson, $85,000 in his freezer.
Who doesn't have $85,000 in their freezer?
But it was marked money that he got in an FBI sting. So, you know, it wasn't just free money. So I think
obviously it's going to have a big effect on this district, but I think Natasha, you did a good job kind of explaining and Brez too, how this kind of blows out and just amplifies that background noise, that background music to everything that we're talking about. One thing I do want to mention though, as we're talking through the national news this week and how it's going to affect the midterms, Natasha, you also wrote this week about this terrible case in Iowa. We already saw the president and the White House raising and kind of brandishing as a wedge issue, basically, before we have a full picture of all the facts here. But it's this college student, Molly Tibbetts, who was murdered, and the man who has been charged with the murder, the authorities are saying that he was in the United States illegally. And this is exactly the sort of thing that Trump has waved as a big flag in the past, right?
So this is a college student whose face you saw, if you're in the Midwest at all, you saw her all the time on TV. And, you know, it was a sweet, smiling college student, and her body, and she was missing. So no one knew what happened. Of course, they thought she had been murdered, but it really captivated people here. So, you know, every day they were sort of raising the reward amount. She was missing for more than 4 weeks. There was, at one point, they thought she was seen in Missouri. So there was I think a lot of public interest and a lot of public, you know, a buildup of emotions around her. So they find her body, and then boom, it's when there's a revelation that it's believed to be someone who's entered, the person charged is someone who's undocumented. I mean, you just knew that this was going to be politicized, and it was. And I mean, Trump that night at a rally, they had charged the man, but they still, even authorities were saying they didn't positively identify her body. So put that in your mind. And then he's already at this rally, just like he's completely all in on this issue. And as that night went on and the next day, I mean, the White House was all in. He had Sarah Huckabee Sanders reading from the Bible before the press conference, bringing up Tibbetts. The president released a Twitter video later, standing outside the White House, talking about Tibbetts' death. So it's really clear that this is going to become his rallying cry. Even though there's a lot of facts that we still don't know, because the suspect's attorney is now saying, no, he is in fact legal. And the farm that this individual was working on, is owned by this Republican family who are really well known in Iowa. And so now they're sort of saying, well, no, we thought he was legal. Wait a minute, maybe he's not. And so there's a lot of confusion still around it, but that's not stopped the president at all.
Charlie, big picture before we take ourselves out here. What's your view on how all the stuff that we talked about kind of affects the race for the midterms, and just as we look forward to November and the possibility of the House flipping, these close race for Senate, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, just speaking to what Natasha brought up, Natasha and I worked on that story together, the Tibbetts story. I edited it. Natasha reported it. But in, to her credit, the minute the Tibbetts thing broke, she emailed me that this thing's going to detonate. And it has. And within hours, Trump was at the rally talking about it, put out, what, two videos yesterday? Statements, videos. He was all over it. Conservative media was all over it. And the reason I bring that up in the context of the 2018 midterms is that these are the kind of cultural politics that Republicans have a history of mastering. And you saw it yesterday where Democrats are playing directly into their hands again, where they were fumbling all over cable TV with their responses. I don't know if you saw the Elizabeth Warren clip, which is brutal, where she is asked about the Molly Tibbetts murder. And in her attempt to pivot, she obviously, you know, sincerely and authentically offers her condolences. But then she pivots into, well, let's talk about the real problems of family separations, and completely dismisses the hurt that this family is going through, and the idea and the concerns that many Americans have, you know, whether they're valid or not, that's what Americans expect out of their public officials, and to dismiss it that way is really problematic. Then you saw Nancy Pelosi in a speech dismissing it in a certain way, maybe not dismissing, but downplaying it and referring to, you know, the Republican farm that he worked on, that the suspect worked on. So I think when Democrats treat these cultural moments with the back of their hand, they increase the risk of not capitalizing in a way that they should. Because as we all know, everybody, you know, on the show today understands that there are historic forces at play here that say that Republicans are going to make enormous gains. There are all these factors out there that in most election cycles would lead to enormous Democratic gains at almost every level. But this is a situation where you see lots of cause for worry for Democrats, not just in 2018, but in 2020, for fumbling away the opportunity. In fact, I was talking to a Republican consultant the other day, and I was really surprised to hear him talk with some certainty. And this person hates Trump, this Republican consultant. You know, he, with a high degree of certainty, thought that Trump was going to win the presidency. And lots of Republicans, and I don't mean non-Trump, I'm talking about not never Trumpers, feel that Trump is going to win re-election, even though they don't want him to, because, and when I ask them why, the reasoning is always the same, is that the Democrats are going to give this to him.
Mm. A lot to think about. Thank you all for jumping in to join us. Natasha, thanks for joining us all the way from Chicago.
Thank you.
And also online, of course, John Bresnahan, all the way from the U.S. Capitol.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much. And Charlie, thank you for being here in the studio, as always.
It was such a treat, Scott, really, just to sit this close to you. You can't always get what you want, but if you try sometime, you might find you get what you need.
Thank you all so much for listening. Our producer this week is Jenny Ament, with help from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is our executive producer. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like the Nerdcast and you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. Thank you again so much for tuning in this week. We will talk to you again next week. To get our fair share of abuse, singing we're gonna vent our frustration. If we don't, we'll blow.
Hey, it's Dan Diamond, the host of Politico's Pulse Check show. I talked with Senator Heidi Heitkamp, the Democrat from North Dakota, and I asked if she was worried that Brett Kavanaugh would overturn the Affordable Care Act's protections if he was confirmed to the Supreme Court.
I think anyone who thinks they know how somebody's going to vote when they get to the Supreme Court is a fool.
And she said a lot more than that. Check out our show with Senator Heitkamp in your podcast player right now. Just search for Politico Pulse Check.